Introduce Mishmar. Like, hey, you should come back next week.
Yeah. Mishmar happens every Thursday night. There's always Cholin, always Torah. And
that's all there is.
All right. There is no more.
What's that? If you want to speak at Mishmar.
Who do you talk to?
For now, approach me.
What is Mishmar?
Yeah.
What does Mishmar mean?
Great question. It means like you can watch.
So
like,
what happens at Mishmar?
Be like this?
Yeah, normally it would be a student giving a shorter bar Torah,
but based on social issues.
Oh, I don't have one.
I'm pointing at. There you go. Hey, Yomi. There are not more source sheets, so this is actually, that was intentional. I wanted you to make friends with each other. The first lesson of Brand Nightmare Stack over there is that there are not enough source sheets for everybody. I say a packet more than a booklet. Hey! Welcome to the base. Welcome to Hilchot Brandeis. This is actually kind of exciting for me because I inherited this shiur from my predecessor. I don't know, like, so this is like from Old Boo, basically. But it's always given on Shabbat, so this is the first time I've ever recorded it. So now that I'm giving it once, I don't have to ever give it again. Hilchot Brandeis is much like Hilchot the rest of your life, in the sense that you always should have a mezuzah on your door, and should regularly keep Shabbat. But so the shiur, I will endeavor to create a balance between things that are idiosyncratic to Brandeis, like, you know, specific mezuzah situations that happen on college campus and won't happen the rest of your life. And, like, frankly, a lot of you are living on your own for the first time. So, you know, there are things that you maybe watch your parents do or not, you know. So, and we'll endeavor to do all of this within the span of 15 minutes. First joke, failed.
Second one was good.
I want to talk about... Mezuzah, that's your branding. Mezuzah, Shabbat candles, non-religious roommates, non-Jewish roommates, implications there. Kiddush, Yichud, caring. I know there's other things, and I know especially like the glaring number 7 is kitchen kashrus for upper class people who have. I know. Everybody who's snapping is obligated to help me find the time where we can do that shear, because that shear does not, like, any of these could be its own shear, so we're really, you know, breakneck speed. So you are now obligated to help me figure out when and where and who and how and who's going to pay for all of it. Okay. If you look at your source booklet, thank you. Fourth joke. Success. If you look at your source booklet, we open traditionally with, not halacha, maybe halacha, meta halacha, if you will. Much like the Rambam opened the Yad with metaphysics, so we'll open with meta halacha, struggling with new ideas. We're all meeting people. We're all meeting new people for the first time. We're meeting people who are Jewish in ways we're not, who are Orthodox in ways we're not, and who like have ideas that we don't have, and we find distasteful. And how do we like how do we struggle with that and deal with that and also like remain in the same community and not kill everybody? We could, you know, again, it's own shir, but I really love this this Petach Hanaim. The Gemara in Erevin, most of you have seen, the Gemara in Erevin is, you know, for 3 years, Beit Shammai and Beit Hillel were arguing with each other, and these were saying, you know, this group was saying, oh, the halacha is like us, and this group, the halacha was like, saying, like, halacha is like us. For 3 years, they were debating one, you know, minute point of halacha. It's a Bakol Va'amra, a prophecy went forth and said, Elu ve'elu divrei Elohim chayim hen. These and those are the words of the living God. They're both the words of the living God. The halacha ke Beit Hillel, but we, you know, in the end, we pass like Beit Hillel. We could talk about that for a long time. Okay, fine. So these and those are the words of Beit Hillel. Are the words of the living God. But then what about the second part of the Bakol? Then why should we listen to Hillel? Shammai is also the words of the living God, right? It's like it's a glaring question. Our answer is because they were humble and pleasant and you know, kindly and modest. What's the translation that I put here? Kindly and modest, and they taught Shammai's words before then. So one could think that okay, there's some kind of mystical after effect that if you are super nice and you defer to your opponent and you like include your opponent's position in your shir, that Hashem will make you right. Right? That there's like a mystical, you know, the world kind of, the moral universe balances itself out. So the Petach Hanaim, the Chida, has this unbelievably rationalistic take that we can all take home. That Misha who anav mistapek im kiven la'emet. Someone who is an anav, someone who is humble, will always question themselves and say, am I actually right? I'm not sure, let me think about it. She'eno machshiv atzmo. No ego, doesn't like, you know, put themselves on some kind of pedestal. Umachazir harbe pa'amim, goes back and back again and again on the argument. V'layen v'lirot im svarato emet. And you're always trying to figure out if you're actually right. So the upshot of being humble isn't that like Hashem will magically make you right. It's that if you're humble, you're more likely to be right because you're actually going to question yourself and you'll make your argument better because you might change your argument along the way. Coddling the American mind when I made this source sheet last year was like a hot, exciting thing. Jonathan Haidt is always hot and exciting as far as I'm concerned. So, you know, go read him. Mezuzah, while you're here. Good. So, positive mitzvah in the Torah to put up a mezuzah. This applies to everybody. You'll live long days. You'll merit long days. Merit Hashem. You have to put it not just on the entrance of your house, but on every particular door. That's source number 6, source number 7. You may have noticed in your long astrocentric days that mezuzahs, like, they're all doorposts. Right? It's so nice, and it points inwards. And does anyone know, like, the Dvar Torah why?
What's the problem?
So, like, it's beautiful. So there was, like, an argument, and they, like, got along, and they reached the middle. It's not exactly that, but that is the Torah. Torah. No, you, like, you nailed it.
It's a miracle, because then, like...
You nailed it.
The wife and the husband should always compromise.
Amen. And that Dvar Torah is true. It's true, even if it's not an accurate representation of how this happened. So this is really anyway, this is in fact the correct Ashkenazi way to post the mezuzah. But for my fellow Sephardim, can I get a what's up? Hello, hey. We'll talk about boss later. We put up our mezuzah like this, straight. Okay, no compromises. Ignore. Ramon Khan does that?
My accident.
Okay. It's okay. He built his own house. Ignore everything I said at the beginning about being humble, etc. No compromises. Okay. Number 8. Many of you have heard that you should leave your mezuzah behind after you leave your home, and this is in fact true. This dates back to the will of Rabbi Yehuda Chassid, and this is in fact our practice, that if you sell your home to another Jew, or if you you're a renter, but you move out August 31st, and September 1st, another Jew's moving in, so you should leave your mezuzah behind, but not if the next homeowner or next tenant is not Jewish. So none of you should leave your upshot for Brandeis even if, let's say, you're living in the Halakhic lobby and you're certain that next year the lobby, you know, well, the thing is in Brandeis, if you don't understand if you're a first year, you actually know, you could know, it's possible to know who's going to be in your room the following year. Still, don't leave your mezuzot behind, because in the meantime, your door is going to be like destroyed and rebuilt and repainted, and they'll remodel the whole thing and they'll destroy the eruv also. And other people will live in during the summer, so you have no idea. So don't leave your mezuzot behind, even if you know who's going to take it behind. But like, you know, mezuzot them later when you're adults and have houses and stuff. Okay. What's the grace period on having on not putting up a mezuzah? Anyone know?
30 days.
30 days. Where?
Outside of Israel,
right? Because in Israel, you buy homes for life until you like resell. But anyway, source number 10 on page number 2 is a really idiosyncratic. It exists in other places. But let's say you have you're not supposed to put a mezuzah up on your bathroom. Let's say you have a Israeli style shower room, where there's no bathroom, there's no toilet in the bathroom, there's just a shower. Or you have a Ridgewood, and you have this like antechamber to your gorgeous, beautiful bathroom.
Yeah, which chamber's an antechamber?
there's a mid-chamber, an antechamber, there's, whatever. So that's a common question, actually. So what do you do with that particular room setup? What do you think? Do we have time for what do you thinks? Okay. Uncompromising. The din is that if a woman or anyone really showers there, since they stand there naked, it's not respectful to put in mezuzah. So basically, the rule is 50% plus time spent in room nakers means no mezuzah. Okay, so it's not it's disrespectful to the mezuzah. Obviously, if we have mezuzahs in our bedroom, obviously we change our clothes at some point, but it's under 50%. So you don't call it nakers in your family? Okay, so the antechamber. I'm seeing like genuinely confused faces. You will learn Pardo little girl lingo in your time here. We will all be same. Okay. Another classic question that comes up in the post scheme. There is a minimum room size. There is a minimum room size. And the minimum room size in the classic halachic literature is 4 by 4 amot. An amma, by the way, I mean, you can look up exactly, 1.52 feet or whatever. An amma is this. Okay. In the British Isles, they call the amma not a cubit, but they called it an L. And your L ends where?
Elbow.
Okay, now you're not going to forget. This is an amma. This is like a classic way to measure things in the ancient world. So 4 amot by 4 amot is the minimum size of what's called a room. Like, you can't live in something that's smaller than that. So your pantry, my pantry, let's say. I don't know about your pantry. My pantry is like not remotely a room. But, right, the bigger it gets, like let's say you have a mirpeset. What's a mirpeset? A balcony. Well, let's say you have a balcony. So some balconies, are like, and some balconies are, So here's the question. When we said earlier 4 amot by 4 amot, did we mean 16 square amot, or did we mean 4 amot by 4 amot? It's a good question. It's a fun sugya. We could learn the Gemara, and so I'll just tell you the answer. It's a machlokas between the Rambam and the Rosh, and if you look at the Shach on page 3... Gonna start getting rid of things. Okay, if you look at the Shach on page 3, the Shach rules that since it is a machlokas between two great Rishonim, I'm not sure who's right, that you should put up a mezuzah without a bracha. Whenever someone tells you to do something and to do it without a bracha, it's because it's a suffix, it's a doubt as to whether you should do it or not. So you're covering your bases. You're doing it. You're getting the upside, but you're not getting the downside of making a bracha of a tal of a blessing in vain. So you should put a mezuzah without a bracha, or you... We're not up to the dorm yet. That's literally the next sentence. The matzah right now is a room that is 16 square amut, but not 4 by 4. So let's say it's like a long and thin room. A 2 by 8, perhaps, or a 3 by 7.
I'm just
all these things. Okay. So speaking of mezuzah without a bracha... So, any implications of this being in a college dorm room? I'm glad you asked. So, here's the thing. Normally in your life, one day you will achieve the American dream and buy a home. When you buy a home, you will like make a bracha on a mezuzah. It's not going to be a question. Before that, you will likely rent, okay? And when you rent, you should understand that you own that place. Now, you don't own it. You haven't bought the place, but you rented it in the sense that you have a certain amount of legally protected and defined ownership over that place. So the question is, does the status of a college student in a dorm room reach the level, hit the minimum threshold of what it means to be a renter, right? So like before this job, we lived in Toronto. Where are my Canadians? Just know them. No. Okay. Montreal. Montreal. Okay. And I was like really upset about the landlord wasn't fixing a heat problem in one of the bedrooms, and like it escalated to the place where I was like calling the city. So what happens if you have a heat problem in your room? Can you call the city of Waltham? No. They don't care. Will you ever in your life be able to file a like slumlord case against the University of Brandeis? Not a chance. So here's the thing. When you moved into your dorm room, you signed this thing, or maybe you implicitly agreed to it. Like, you know, by moving to this room, you agreed to the following. Probably called something like rights and responsibilities, where the university curtails your rights and increases your responsibilities to a like staggering degree. None of it mitzvahim should matter. You shouldn't be like horrible, violent people or get kicked out of the school. But in the event that happens, you get kicked out. So what can we call this rental? That's the question. So if you see the Shu'a Shevet Halevi, he's dealing with the question of people in extended hospital stays. So that's a really good analog, if you think about it, right? Because if you're in the hospital, you don't really have any bylaws. You don't have any ownership over the hospital room at all. And they can move you around at will. They reserve that right. But you're there for more than 30 days. You're there for a long time. He says in the surah, the second bold parsha, Choli meinam sochrim, the first bold parsha, Choli meinam sochrim habayit, rak shenotnim schar avur ma shehem sham. They don't rent the house. They are only paying in order to be there. And then the second bolded part, Hachinami, Benidon Didan, in our case, Lo Chashiv Abayit Shelo Klal, the house is not considered his. Velechayv Mi Derabanan Mishum, Demichzi Kishelo, and to say that the person is Chayv Mi Derabanan to put him in mezuzah, Lo Shayach Hacha. It doesn't make sense here, Kasher Biersham Otei, because it was clarified earlier. And if you look at the second paragraph where, you know, it digs deeper, Vekolze Lo Shayach Bebeit Cholim, Sheino Socher Abayit Ela Zchut Liosham. He doesn't rent the room. He only rents the right to be in the room. So he concludes that you don't need to put up a mezuzah even if you're an extended stay in a hospital. And I think that's the case here. That being said, I still strongly urge and encourage people to put up mezuzahs. Mezuzahs, if you look, maybe next year I'll remember to print it. And the Rambam explains like the idea of a mezuzah. That every time you walk through the door, that it should awaken your heart, and it should wake you up, and you should remember your relationship to Hashem, your relationship to the world, and blah, blah, blah. You know, so that's true. All that's true, and it's really the biggest siman of being a righteous Jew, having that mezuzah there, so you should have it. But, as I clarified earlier, when you have a suffix, you do it and not make the bracha. So I would encourage you to put up your mezuzah and not make the bracha. Any questions about mezuzah before we move on to Shabbat candles? Yes.
What if the mezuzah falls off the door? This recently happened to me.
Yes.
Do you say a bracha?
No.
What if you can't put it up for a day?
So there's a time period. I don't think it's a day though. I think a day is fine. But ask in the newly minted Shoot Brandeis WhatsApp group, and I promise to do the research. Are you an admin now?
No. What's the
group? Alana's an admin.
I'm not.
Talk to Ellie. Talk to Ellie, Ezra, Ben. Okay, great. Yes. Shh. Yeah.
It doesn't matter which way
it's slanted. It should be slanted the direction that you're walking into the door. So obviously you tend to walk into doors both ways, but Unless you have one of those houses that's like a, you know, like my girls just run around in circles around there, like between the dining room to the kitchen to the living room to the, you know, okay.
I turned so. Around today.
Yeah, but the way you generally walk in, right? So your front door, it's obvious.
Walk into the room. Yeah. Like,
yeah. I'll tell you, like, a more interesting question. People in their mirpasets traditionally have it pointing in the house, on their balcony, pointing in the house, and that might be wrong. It might be more correct to say that you enter the mirpaset, that you enter the balcony, that you don't, you know, that where do you start? You start in the living room and you walk out into the balcony.
When you use the door, are you using it for the mirpaset? You're using it, if the mirpaset wasn't there, like, you don't go in. The primary purpose of the door is to use the mirpaset, means going outside.
Cool? Okay, moving right along. Shabbat candles. Okay, so you should light them, right? It's a nice thing to do. So the Rambam clarifies here that it's not like some nice optional thing. It's not like a bonus mitzvah, like, I don't know, like dry cleaning your clothes or buying flowers for Shabbos, but like it's a real thing. You have to make a bracha. This applies to men and women. Equally, the Mechaber Shulchan Aruch, not the Rambam here, but the Shulchan Aruch later says that the reason women tend to do it more is because women tend to be in the home more. So that, if you take that to a theological, you know, extension, if you, I don't know, I don't want to talk about stay-at-home dads now, because that would be interesting. But, I don't know, think about it. Okay. But anyway, point is that it applies to all male dorms the same way it applies to all female dorms. Common question, and you know, will come up in your time here. What do you do when you're a guest, right? So, I imagine most of us don't think about this until you're independent, because you just, you know, you live at home and you like, you know, your mom lights, and you go somewhere else and like their mom lights. And what do you do when you're a guest? So the Shulchan Aruch Harav says, "B'med varim avrim," he's inside of another sugya. "Keshochelat mishala, aval im hi smuchal shulchan bala bayit, ena yechola leverachshan." Elim can a cheder miyuchad la. So if she, meaning they, but like she, is a guest, so they shouldn't light. They shouldn't light unless there's a specific room that's just for them. And then in that particular room, then they would light. So the Shulchan Aruch Harav built a halacha case that when you're a guest, you don't light because the lighting is on the home. Lighting is on the home and not on the individual. So that has to be a candle there. It has to be light there. And as long as there's light there, then beseder, unless you have like a room that doesn't have a light in it. This seems to make sense. However, it is not the practice. It's not the practice, I think, in general. If you ask people who tend to be guests at other people's homes, they tend to bring their... I mean, put it this way. You go to Teaneck, if you go to like that Shop and Save place, or the like Amazing Savings. Okay, they sell... They sell travel candles. Why should you have travel candles? Because, you know, Shulchan Aruch Harav. You should, like, protest outside the Amazing Savings. If they have to get rid of their travel candles, it's against the Shulchan Aruch Harav. In fact, so Lubavitcher Rebbe in the 80s started a campaign for single women to start lighting. Paying attention, Kepler. Single women to start lighting. And it's caused, like, a ruckus amongst the Hasidim. While under their parents' house, correct. Yeah, for like girls from like bat mitzvah. I mean, those of you who like grew up going to Chabad, you get bat mitzvah candles. So that's okay. I don't want to get into the number of candles. It's not whatever. It's not important. But okay, so like a lot of people got like really upset. Lubavitcher Rebbe and Rav Avadia, I think, stopped talking at that point. Okay, and in Rav Schechter's Sefer Mipnei HaRav, he reports that when the Rav heard about this and it was asked, like, oh, what about the ruckus? He's like, what do you mean? That's what we do in our home. So it's the same concept. Like, if you're lighting in your own parents' home, then you definitely light in a guest home. So what I mean to say is, I guess in an overly complicated way, is there are two perfectly reasonable and actionable positions. Here's, like, another interesting question. When to make the bracha before or after? So, let's play charades. Who am I? I'm the Shabbos Ima. Okay. Anyone ask the Shabbos Ima why the Shabbos Ima like does like what's with this? Okay. So I'm gonna quickly walk you through.
Rav put it as smooth out the minds of the unbelieving.
That's amazing. Do you hear that? Okay. Let me quickly walk you through a very involved sogya. In general, in halakha, in almost every case, when you do something and there's a bracha attached to that thing, you say the bracha and do the thing. You pick up the apple, you before you eat the apple, you make the bracha, and then you eat the apple. You know, you pick up the gulab. Well, okay, that's actually complicated. But because we're avoiding the situation. But in theory, you put the lulav down, you make the bracha, and you pick up the lulav, right? You pick up the talit, you make the bracha, and then you put on the talit. You don't put it on and then make the bracha. You don't, you don't drink the wine, the kiddush. I did the apple already, so whatever. I'm sorry. No, thank you.
Blow the shofar.
You don't blow the shofar and make the bracha. That'd be crazy. Thank you, Shoshi. Shoshi Fry. Okay, except for candles. So candles is complicated because there's a sheet of the Bahag that says that when women light candles, and specifically women, when women light candles, they accept Shabbat. That is how women accept Shabbat. That is like the normal way for women to accept Shabbat is to light candles. Therefore, when if you were to light the candle, if you were to make the bracha, it would be Shabbat for you. And then you'd light the candle, and then you'd be in big trouble because you just broke Shabbat, like 3 milliseconds after you started it. So therefore, you see in this Ramah, that's not numbered because the numbering was just too difficult at a certain point, but the Ramah, OC263:5, who explains that because of this Bahag, you have to light the candles first, right? But we're still worried about over lasiata, and we're worried about this rule that you have to make the bracha first, so you cover your eyes right away. So you cover your eyes so you don't get the hana, you don't get the pleasure, the benefit of the candles. And then after you finish making the bracha, and saying nice things, and gotten Avraham, and whatever, you say in your home, then you can open your eyes and get the candles. So, sorry. What?
Oh, look, candles.
Okay, so why is this interesting? Yes. Yes.
What about if a woman is wearing a shawl and they made the verbal declaration?
I'll talk about that in a second, because all this is, relevant here. Because here's the thing, folks. Candles, everyone in this room is chayvin candles, but this Bahag applies to women. Because when the Bahag said this, it traditionally applied to women. You didn't have guys living on their own lighting Shabbat candles. So, yes.
Also, what about the whole concept of lighting and having in mind when you're making the bracha that you're not bringing Shabbat yet, so you can go and just...
We'll talk about that in a second. Okay, so this Bahag is limited to women. Therefore, it's a big machlokas program. It's a big machlokas. If this whole business of this applies to men also. So it is a machlokas achronim. On the one side, the Derech Haim says, do the same thing because it's a low plug. When we say something applies, it applies across the board. Otherwise, I don't know. Mix the thing. And on the other side, you have Rabbi Kiva Eger and you have the Chai Adam who say, no, this whole over La Siyatan thing is more important than applying this plug across the board. So, two options. I'm not telling you which one's better. It's a Machlokas Achronim. Also Yom Tov. So Yom Tov, what's our whole fear with this is that you're accepting Shabbos, right? So people who don't think that there's a this position, specifically the position not of the Sma, but of the Sma's wife. He quoted his wife, and he had this amazing ha'ara. Now on Yom Tov, it's mutter to cook. So if it's mutter to cook, so we're not worried about you breaking Yom Tov by lighting. So therefore, the position of the Sma's wife is that you make the bracha before you light on Yom Tov. The Magen Avraham disagrees, but the Chacham don't think he's right. So I'm telling you, this, we actually pass with the Sma's wife, that because of Yom Tov cooking that we light, everyone lights before.
What's the Sma's wife's name?
The Sma's wife? What's the Sma's name? Okay.
What's the Sma's there? What's the relationship with Yom Tov?
Because the whole way this started was because we're worried that you'll accept Shabbos and then you'll light the candle. But on Yom Tov, You're allowed to.
You can't light a candle.
We'll talk about Yom Tov closer to Yom Tov, but you're correct. You can't light a candle. However, lighting of a new fire on Yom Tov is maximum an Isra Derabanan. It's a rabbinic prohibition. So in the bigger calculus...
First, it's not a problem accepting Shabbat. It's not a problem accepting Shabbat because the Hanukkah is part of Shabbat, just like cooking part of Yom Tov. That's the alarming.
One more time, I'm sorry. I'm trying to stay out of the fan, so I'm like...
You made the problem first, and there's not a problem that you're accepting Shabbat and doing Malacha, because the Malacha that you're doing is like the Shabbat, just like cooking is the Shabbat.
You want to say that that's true for Shabbat?
I thought that's what she said.
No, but you can't cook for Shabbat.
No, just
if
you can cook on Yom Tov, you can light on a candle on Shabbat.
No, it's like...
So what's your logic then?
But that, no, your thing's not true. You can't light a candle on Shabbat.
Oh, she's talking about the Rav before.
Yeah. Okay. Maybe too involved. Next year we'll like skip the details there. Okay. All of which is to say that that young women can light the way they saw their mothers light. Young men have a decision to make whether they're going to do it over Lasiatan or this way. Yom Tov is different. Do you accept Shabbat when you light? So that's a bigger thing than we can talk about right now. It seems to be that because of this Bahag, that women auto accept Shabbat, unless they verbally declare otherwise. It's not clear the verbal declaration. It, unless it's like a major Shas Eschak, it's a major emergency situation that you need to do something on Shabbat. Keep in mind, by the way, folks, that if you accept Shabbat early, cool across the board, you can still ask other people to do Malacha for you. It's so hot down here. I want to talk quickly about lighting in the dorms. There are two problems with lighting in the dorms. Number one.
Safety.
That's number two. Because, for some reason at Brandeis, they let you light in the dorms. So we have to address that first. I don't know yay, Brandeis. I'm not sure. Brandeis does allow you to light in the dorms. There is a form, if I'm not mistaken. Someone who's a CA can say. There's a form. DCL has a... Oh, Hillel, whatever. I mean, Hillel gives it to DCL. Has a form that you're supposed to fill out if you light. And if you light, they tell you that you're supposed to float your candles in... can't do that. It's actually a Mishnah in Shabbos. It's bizarre. Like, they picked out, it's like, Mishnah no one ever learned. You can't do that because it's something called Ram Kivui, that it's causing the candle to extinguish earlier. And by setting that up, even if you set it up before Shabbos, you're part of this, like, system of Ram Kivui. So you cannot float your candles in water, and so then you're in trouble. Give me a second. If you really want to light with fire, then you can do that. Floated in sand, I suppose. Like sand is, or maybe you can like take a fire extinguisher and make a tin full of that stuff, and then put your candles in that. Your CA will be very happy with you. But allow me to get to problem number two, which is the mechilas Louis Brandeis fire. Like that's crazy. Like you're not going to be there. Think about it. That's crazy. The person in the craziest was Rav Moshe. Why did Rav Moshe think this was particularly crazy and write about this at length, about how it's bad to have fire in the dorms? What do you think?
Because his dorm burned down.
Right? And inside, I don't have a follow-up joke. Anyway, so... No, he didn't go to college. His yeshiva. Like, not the yeshiva he went to, the yeshiva that he was the Rosh Yeshiva. But the records say Rav Moshe did not go to Brandeis. Contrary to popular opinion. Yes. Yeah, I know that guy actually. He felt very bad. Needless to say. Okay, so you look at problem number two, fire Igros Moshe. He talks about on Hanukkah how important it is to have someone stay behind when you light Hanukkah candles and you draw straws. Shuthartz, he talks about using electricity. So does the Shemir Shabbos. Let me tell you, friends, as an Orthodox Jew, use electricity. I highly recommend it. It was invented some 100 years ago. You don't have to worry about it going out. You don't have to worry about it. You don't pay the electricity in your dorms. You don't have to worry about setting your partner on fire, usually. I mean, it's happened. It is a machlokas if, like, your, you know, rabbi back home says, like, oh, what did that rabbi Brennan say? Like, oh, electricity. Like, oh, it's a machlokas modern post-game if electricity works. But, like, you're not firmer than the Shmir Shabbos Kehilchasa, so... Because he didn't go to Brandeis. I'm killing it in this section right here. Okay. But do so, if you do so, do so with incandescent bulbs, not fluorescent bulbs, not LED bulbs. Because that's a bigger machlokas and it might not work at all. Okay. Kiddush. Oh my god. Section number 3. Lucky for you, there's no notes on section number 3. I didn't have time to put it together. But this is really important because you're going to ask me about this inevitably. Sorry? I'm gonna barrel through this like a monkey on fire. Non-religious roommates or non-Jewish roommates. Here's the thing: you're gonna ask me about this. You're gonna want to know about it now. There's something called a mirlo nafrei. Okay. There's something called not telling non-Jews to do things for you. There are two parts of that. Okay. Everyone. Oh, wink. Right. There are two parts of that. One part is not telling, and there's a completely separate part called not benefiting. Okay? So if you figure out some system where you wink 3 times, it means turn on the TV, that's not good. Because you still, that's not true anyway, like you're talking through your eyes. But you can't get hana anyway, and that's where most of the questions happen, right? Because you shouldn't be asking your roommate to do things, your non-Jewish roommate to do things anyway, and you can't get hana from that. You can't, if you're sitting in a room by yourself and it's dark, and your roommate's like, you shouldn't sit in the dark, your mom would be so upset, and flips on the lights, you can't use the lights to read. You can't use the lights to do anything that you wouldn't be able to do otherwise. Exception to the rule. Is that clear? This is from a non-Jew. And it's true for a Jew as well, sorry. Here are the exceptions that only apply to non-Jew. The exceptions are, if a non-Jew does it for themselves, if a non-Jew turns on the light because they want to read, you can also read. That's exception number 1. If a non-Jew does it for folks in the room, okay, if it's not like, it's just getting dark in the room because, like, you were saying Zmiros and whatever, okay, and they turn on the light, now you have to do quick math. Are most people in the room Jewish or not Jewish? If the majority of the room is Jewish and they did it for the room, then they did it for the Jews, and it's prohibited. If the majority of the people in the room are not Jewish, and they did it for the room, they did it for the non-Jewish majority of the room, it's permitted, okay? I'm asked a lot about coffee on the treif side on Shabbat. So they make that coffee on Shabbat. They heat the water on Shabbat, they maybe strain another shear, okay? Can you have the coffee on the treif side on Shabbat is a really interesting question, because they make that coffee for folks in the room. Who are folks in the room? So this is actually the subject of a JCA investigative article last spring about how many Jews actually are at Brandeis. Okay, I'm serious, think about it. If, like, Brandeis is telling you 40 to 60%, but the JCA is telling you really 30 to 40%. Edith Sherman, great. More Jews in Sherman than in Yuzdan, right, on average, because all the kosher facilities are there. So it's an interesting question and not something that we can get to the bottom of today. Okay.
Wait, what's the answer? Oh, can you go to Yuzdan and have a coffee?
Yeah, but how are you going to pay for it?
Yeah.
Hey, guys! Stealing things isn't okay. I know, like, you think that it is, but it's not. Oh, look! There's extra spoons here. I can steal... No, you can't steal them. You can't just, like, take stuff. Okay. There's a whole system of paying for things on campus. It's not cash. It's points, and the points are fictitious. But so is cash. That's how the movie... oh, my God. Fight Club ends, okay? That's the whole thing. That is literally not the point of the movie. Chill out. Okay, I'm gonna stop taking questions and stop making jokes. Okay, stop laughing. I'm going to talk quickly about Kiddush. So, Kiddush, there used to be that like the hot topic issue was, you know, women make Kiddush for a man, and that used to be in the Makor sheet, and then Hillel stopped doing that, so it's not in the Makor sheet anymore, so you'll never know. Okay, what does Hillel do instead? Hillel has it that everybody says Kiddush. So why is that on the Makor sheet? It's actually not. I didn't have a chance to pull up the Makor, but I'll tell you what it is. There is a halachic concept called Trei Kale Lo Mishtame, that two voices you can't hear. So if there's two voices singing at the same time, you can't hear both voices. This comes up in all sorts of wild contexts. And why does it come up this Friday night and the Friday night after and the Friday night after? Because you have to make Kiddush if you're in such a situation. You can't say, like, I'll chill out and listen to the Kiddush. Because you can't. Because 700 people, that's how many people show up to Hillel dinner. I said no more jokes. Because, like, 100 people are making Kiddush simultaneously. You can't hear 100 people. I can talk about that more, but I'm not going to. Okay, that's my thing. With Kiddush, you can use plastic cups. Plastic cups, some people think that you can't use plastic cups. I think you can use plastic cups because they're not temporary. We just throw them out because we're rich. But if we were poor, you'd hold on to the plastic cups. Yes, Alyssa.
People say that you should double up the plastic cups.
So people do the double up thing. I have not managed to find where in any, like, there's no mention in the post game or anything that double up is an advantage. I can understand socially why someone would think so. They would think so, like, oh, because it's a temporary cup, but if I put two together, it's permanent. But now that I said it out loud, does it sound like it makes sense anymore? Okay, so if you want to put two cups together, I'm not going to tell you you can't, but I will tell you that you don't have to. Okay, that's it for Kiddush. We could do like a chart about, like, you know, how many guys, how many girls in a room, etc. Blah blah blah. I mean, there are like handy dandy books here, and I quoted for you at length in the Makoros. But I will just say the following. I will go on the record now, and you could be upset at me for saying this now, and not be upset at me for not saying this later. It's a real thing. It's a real thing. It's not like a chumrah that they taught you in Shana Aleph and like some Hasidim still keep. It's a real, like, on the books thing, and it's a real on the books thing because it's true, because, like, it makes sense. Because here's the reality: in spaces where we build gedarim, spaces where we build fences for ourselves, are spaces of kedusha, and it's hard to build kedusha in spaces of lack of gedarim. You might think, like, not me, but like, no, like everybody. Everybody's mortal, and putting yourself into a place where there are no gedarim is also not a good idea. Just because you're not the one responsible for the lack of gedarim, not victim blaming, chalila, etc., but right, you choose to put yourself into a place of no gedarim, so you're choosing to put yourself in a place of lack of kedusha. So I encourage you to actually think about the parameters of yichud in your time here and beyond. Okay, quickly about caring. All that I want to say, there's a map of the Eruv here. If you're a first year, you're unlikely to go outside of the newly expanded Eruv. But this is the map, and learn it well. On the reverse side is this nifty picture. It might not be the reverse for you. It's the opposite for you. Okay. On the opposite side for you, there's this picture of keys. Why are there a picture of keys? Is this some kind of, like, deep Hasidic message about unlocking the potential in college? No. It is not. So those of you who will end up leaving the Eruv because you, like, really want to chill with your friends on Wheelock, okay, might put your keys on a hairband, or a scrunchie. No, not a scrunchie, it's a hairband. Is it a hairband? Can I get a lot? I got it out. Thank you. Ponytail, a pony. You will put your key on a pony, and then you will ride a horse on Shabbos. Okay. That doesn't work. I hate to be, like, the bearer of bad news. That's the same thing as caring. It's just caring by, like, attaching it to yourself as opposed to in your hands. Okay, what does work? What does work is this. What does work is making your key part of a link in a chain, right? So just the same way that, like, if you had a belt with links on it, because you were, do hipsters even do that? I don't know. Okay, that's still a belt. It has links, multiple links in the chain. Well, I lost my thing as well. Okay, but you're not carrying the individual links, of course not. So that's what you should do with your key. There used to be a senior here named Vanessa Shalem who made these adorable bracelets for people. She still makes those bracelets. Okay, so you should. You can't friend her on Facebook because. But she's Vanessa Ch.
Yeah, Vanessa Ch.
I'm sorry I said that on the recording. Now it like recovers low. Okay, but anyway. Look at this. But also, you can go to Amazon and get a Shabbos belt for $10. They sell them on Amazon. They're amazing. Quit. I'll take questions in a second. Another quick thing. I don't know how big Fireball is anymore, but last year I realized that it's huge. It's literally not kosher. Not like, oh, Rabbi. No. It's not kosher. And it's not kosher, by the way. It's not traced because of the cinnamon flavor, and this is why it's important. So I want to explain something. I know none of you are ever going to drink ever, so this is Torah Lishma, okay? Someone's going to tell you at some point in your life that hard alcohol is kosher. All of it. Okay. Fireball's a great example of why it's so dumb. Why is that so dumb? And this is what you'd never know. Where's Fireball from? Canada. That's why it's trade. No. In Canada, they have something called Canadian whiskey, and that's why it's trade. No, seriously. In Canada, they have a different tax system set up where wine and hard liquor are taxed at different rates. In fact, wine is taxed at a lower rate. Their alcohol is like ridiculously regulated. You have to go to the LCBO, everyone's upset about it, but they think the whole system's great. I don't know. Talk to Canadians. Okay, wine is cheaper than booze. So what do you than hard liquor? So what do you do if you're making a lot of hard liquor? You pour wine in it, and you tell the government it's 50% wine. That means you have to drop my tax rate. There's wine in Fireball. Okay, you wouldn't know that by looking at the label. All that all they tell you is it's Canadian whiskey, and if you hadn't gone to the shoot, you wouldn't know that Canadian whiskey can or may not be trafe, but you have to know the brand. So that's why there's like a gazillion lists online. You can find one on your own. It's been in the boo email since, thank God, like I suggested it 3 years ago, and like it never left. It's bizarre. That's like my one lasting contribution to the boo email is the booze list.
Who's not gotten chillin' yet but wants? Raise your hand. Like really high. Alright, we need three more, Alicia.
One last thing, folks. Something that I was actually asked about specifically is about what's kosher on campus. This is specifically for the first years. Okay, Sherman is kosher, and Louis is kosher. They're both under the hashgacha of Rabbi Zirkind. Is Louis closing or removing? Why is everyone so upset? It's moving. Louis is staying. Support Louis. Okay. It's a deli in Yuzdan, and it's okay. Okay, shh, that's not... Okay. Dunkin' Donuts is kosher in a complicated way. Not anymore. Oh, they're closing. Right.
Close.
Kiss Dunkin' goodbye!
They're reopening.
It was bad coffee, they just put a lot of sugar in it.
They're reopening.
If they reopen, we'll discuss again. Coffee on this campus is kosher. It's not necessarily kosher, it just happens to be that all of my investigation of ingredients at Einstein's, at Starbucks, and at Pete's has resulted in a lack of non-kosher ingredients. So that's wonderful, but no one monitors that. So, excuse me, if you're getting like, let's say a spiced chai latte, here's the sad news. There are no people in the back who are spicing the chai tea leaves as they put in your latte. There is a disgusting concentrate that they dump into your black tea. That thing has a hexer on it as of right now. Is it going to have tomorrow? Give me a second. Is it going to have a hexer tomorrow? I don't know. You should ask. You should say, can I see the bottle? And if you find something that's not kosher, you should make me aware of that. And then everyone will be aware of that.
I did that this week. I went to Einstein's this week. I looked at all their syrups. So, a few of them have a chafke, which are the chai mix, the chocolate, chocolate, caramel, and white chocolate syrups all have a cupcake, and the pumpkin, hazelnut, and vanilla do not.
Do not?
No.
Pumpkin, vanilla, hazelnut, snaps for Shoshi Finkel.
Shoshi!
New classes. Huh? Oh, frappuccinos are not kosher also. Thank you, Casey. Shut up! They've never been kosher. Okay. Hazelnut? Yes, Ellie.
I have a question.
How does the air get checked?
Okay, Last and final plug. Say it loud. I can. Okay, good.
Also,
question.
Are the smoothies
kosher? Smoothies
or
smoothies?
I
now need to go to Einstein's again, so I'm not going to say anything about Einstein's. You can ask. Tell them that you have an allergy and you need to see the thing, okay? It's not, like, crazy. You have an allergy to tray food. It's true. Okay. Folks, that Eruv that's up there, that's glorious and allows you to carry your not fireball to nowhere, that allows you to carry and to be part of the community and to push your baby stroller and so forth, it doesn't check itself. There was a guy who told me that he could set up like an electronic system that the Eruv would check itself. It didn't pan out. Okay, so it doesn't check itself. In fact, there is a noble, other word for noble, magnificent, dedicated, blue, respectable, loyal, fierce, vengeful committee of Eruv checkers. Like 75% of them graduated last spring. And they were amazing people, and we're glad that they graduated, and they graduated when they did. That said, joining the Eruv committee is a fun and edifying addition to your college experience. I will teach you. You will know more about Eruvin than 99% of Jews. 99% of Orthodox Jews. Okay? Like, you're going to, like, okay? You're going to be a master of disaster and of Eruvin. So talk to me. It's not a huge commitment, and it is even fun, and you can get a workout out of it. A lot more people do it. Oh, the more people who join, the less work it is. So think about that. We also need Shabbos Mashgichim. It is a very small job. It's not time intensive. It doesn't result in more time spent with me, unfortunately. But it is also rewarding. And talk to Salty Alti there in the back about your interest in being a Mashgiach. In the interest of Kach Sof and good feelings, I'm going to ask you to ask me questions later or join the newly minted Brandeis group and ask your questions there. Thank you for bearing with me. It's important for me to get through it. Because these are questions that I get all the time, and you know. But now you're empowered. Okay, you're an empowered Jew, and now someone's going to take over and sing.
Also, really quick, before we start singing chocolate, tomorrow morning is at 8:25 a.m. and it's at 6 p.m.